Welcome to Altair 4, gentlemen. I am to transport you to the residence. If you do not speak English, I am at your disposal with 187 other languages along with their various dialects and sub-tongues.
You are a robot, aren't you?
That is correct, sir. For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie.
Hey, Doc, is it a male or a female?
In my case, sir, the question is totally without meaning.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard. Today, I have a panel of guests to talk about the new anthology, Robots Through the Ages. I've got editor Brian Thomas Schmidt and contributors Ken Scholes and Martin Shoemaker. We're talking robots, AI, Roombas, C-3PO, and more. So let's get to the show. Thank you for joining me here at Retro Rockets. Let's go around and everybody introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about yourself, and where we can find you online.
I'm Brian Thomas Schmidt. I am the editor of the volume we're discussing today and a bunch of other stuff. You can find me at Brian Thomas S, basically, B-R-Y-A-N-T-H-O-M-A-S-S on Twitter and Facebook. If you just put Facebook.com or Twitter.com, put that Brian Thomas Schmidt on Instagram. So there you go.
My name is Ken Scholes. I'm a writer and a singer-songwriter. I have books out in the U.S. through Tor and through Fairwood Press, along with scatterings of magazines and anthologies over a 23-year career in print. You can find me at www.kenscholes.com. That's K-E-N-S-C-H-O-L-E-S. And you can also find me on Facebook, where I do most of my interactions with fans and friends and family. But your best path there is to send me a personal note saying that you're going to send a Fred request so that I know that it's not some scammer or someone just trying to beef out their follower list.
I am Martin L. Shoemaker, writer of science fiction, mostly occasional fantasy, and when I feel like I want to waste my time, mystery, because there aren't a lot of markets for those. You can find me at my much neglected website, shoemaker.space. It does have my content, but probably nothing in the last year and a half, so I have to get an update done for that. Also, Martin L. Shoemaker on Facebook and shoemaker.space on Twitter.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Brian, my first question is for you. Robots Through the Ages includes over 100 years of robot stories, which is just very, very cool for me. How did you get the idea to combine robot stories of different eras?
Well, I've been wanting to do robot anthology because, you know, robots were big when I was a kid. So I've been wanting to do a robot anthology for a long time. I've tried a couple other things. But then Bob Silverberg, who's a legend in the business, Robert Silverberg, one of the grandmothers of science fiction, in case anybody that's listening hasn't heard of him. I mean, he's had Bicentennial Man was a Robin Williams movie that was made about a robot that was from one of his stories with Asimov. The Positronic Man that he developed, they developed a novel from a shorter story. Anyway, when Bob said he wanted to do something, you know, I wanted to do something. He didn't want to do all news stories. We wanted to do something with some historical heft, something that, you know, would have something to say about the history of things. And I thought, man, let's do robots. So he loved the idea. And it always was called Robots Through the Ages. And so here we are. And, you know, I'm thrilled because he's one of my all-time heroes. So I get to work with him and call him my friend and get to see, learn from him about, stories that what he looks for and all those things. So it was like, you know, a win-win.
What was it like to work with him? He is a legend.
Well, yeah, you know, Bob's he's a nice guy. He's in his 80s. So, you know, he's slower than he'd like to be. So, you know, I actually, there were times when I would carry the workload and other times when he'd do stuff and we kind of coordinated our efforts. He said, no, I'm way behind on my reading. Anything after like the 1980s, I can't really definitively define. So I'll do everything before that. And I took care of everything after. We both read, of course, everything. We edited the stories and I took care of recruiting the the news stories, and we got probably three of the best stories I've ever edited in this book. And then we just kind of ran with it from there. So yeah, it was a fun experience. We're doing more. We're going to do more books together. I don't know if we're going to do another Robots. I hope we are, but we're going to definitely do some other books. Our next book we're working on is Moon Life, which is about basically, you know, looking towards the new moon landing and, you know, different, the way we've thought about life on the moon all this time, you know. But anyway, so that's kind of what happened, and here we are.
Fantastic. I love that. And I'm all about that Life on the Moon anthology, by the way.
Yeah. It would be very cool.
Very cool.
I like to do these historical things. I've done two Infinite Stars anthologies, which are basically kind of across the spectrum space opera and military sci-fi. And I like to do the things. In everything I do, I try to include an older story because I think where we came from is just as important as where we are. And I really think a lot of new readers don't want to do the work to go back and find those things. So for me, if I can keep those in front of a new audience and remind you, hey, that's where this came from, by the way, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what Robots Through the Ages is really about, because you can read through and you can see where all these different ideas and, you know, the hardest part, in fact, was, you know, Bob had picked all these great stories from the 50s. And I said, hey, Bob, this book can't be all the 1950s. We have a limited word count. We have to actually cut some of the great legendary stories. That was tough. And there's stuff like decisions you have to make like that. But, you know, because we wanted to do a survey of where it came from. It is a little 1950s heavy still, but that's where it all started for most of us. So back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, classic golden age.
Yeah, I do want to come, something you said a moment ago about we're here because of where we came from. I want to come back to that in just a couple of minutes. But first I want to ask you, so there is hundreds of thousands of robot stories that have been written and published in the last 100, 120 years. How did you decide which ones to include?
Well, first of all, one really handy resource is on Wikipedia. There's a list of robots, like a list of robot stories, like on everything from TV to literature. So the first thing I did is look at that. I said, okay, what do we have? We're looking for prose. We're not looking for TV. So what do we have that we can actually find stories about? The second thing, Bob started listing all the famous robot stories that he could think of. I started listing the ones that I could think of and the people that had written stuff that had impacted me. And on that list was Today I Know Today I Am Paul, Today I Know is the news story by Martin Shoemaker, and then The Psalms of Isaac by this guy named Ken Scholes. And, you know, there were a bunch of different people's stories that I know were favorites of mine. And so I, you know, I started looking at just compiling a Google Drive of all these different stories and then going out and Googling award-winning robot stories, you know, and finding all those and putting them in a drive. And then, you know, of course, we're looking for Asimov and Bradbury and all of these different people. And who are who's known for this, you know, and just putting them in a Google Drive and sharing them so that we could go through them and figure out, okay, what do we want to do here? And we're not just looking at, you know, it's not just meant to be the best ever written. All these stories are the best. It's meant to be great stories, but also how we look at things differently over time. So you had to kind of balance the two things and not just, you know, it's certainly never intended to be complete. I mean, we wanted to do it twice as big, and it's already big. It's already 500 pages. We wanted to do it twice as big, but Blackstone wanted to do, you know, shorter first.
Yeah. You do need to keep those things at 500 to 600 pages. It's, if you're going to hit 1,000 pages, it's time to do two volumes.
Hey, I figure it's still big enough that it can serve as a doorstop if somebody gets bored. So, you know, dual purpose.
You gotta love that. You gotta love that. So absolutely, coming back to how ideas have changed over the years and just where we came from as a just a culture that tells stories about robots. The oldest story in the anthology is A Night at Moxon's. And it was published in 1899, which was I was surprised to see that year. It was a happy surprise. 1899, two stories that were written quite recently. How has our idea of robots and how we tell stories about them, how has that, and how we react to those stories, how has that changed over time?
Well, it's funny because I think, you know, if you look at, Robert Silverberg did a great essay at the beginning of the book that really talks about a lot of this stuff. But, you know, there's the original term for robot actually came from a guy named Capek, who wrote R.U.R., which is a play. And I'm trying to remember where he's from originally. He is let's see. There were many Slavic words related to robota, by the way, but he's Czech, I believe. Karol Čapek. No, he's from Poland. Oh, he's a Czech writer. No, he's a Czech writer. Okay. He's a Czech writer. And I had to double check because I couldn't remember. And so there's a lot of different thoughts about these. The Jews had their theory of the golem, for example, which we have a story about that in here. And you've got a lot of things. And then, of course, my whole generation would see everything from, you know, we had the Jetsons, of course. Everybody wanted their robot made, right? You know? And then we had R2-D2 and C-3PO, who changed everything for me because they were the first time I saw robots are real, man, you know? And then you had the robots in Black Hole, Old Bob and Vincent, and then you had... And Maximilian, who was the bad one, and then the Cylons and Tweaky on Buck Rogers. And then there was Gigantor, there's all these cartoon robots. So, I mean, I was looking back at the 50s, 60s, 70s yesterday on YouTube thinking, what are all the robots? And we were lucky. All three of us that are on this as your guests here, I think all grew up in an age where robots were, I mean, we've seen them all the time. So for us, robots were like a thing, you know, whereas, I think, you know, when the people first started imagining them, it was kind of like, could this even be possible? H.G. Wells and others way back in the day, you know, it was like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to have mechanical men? Because mechanical men stories go way, 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 way back. Steampunk, mechanical men are a big thing. Ken can probably speak more to that because he's written about mechanical men, Isaac being a mechanical man. But anyway. So all of that is stuff that you look at. And now the way that it's changed, to get to your question, is it's changed from being kind of a more of a fantastical idea to it's a reality now. And there are robots now. I mean, of course, we're in the middle of the AI crisis, so we can't forget that. And everybody's worried about what AI could do. I was reading an article the other day about how the military trained some drones, and the drones actually, they were told you could only get points off this. So they tried to kill the operator.
I heard about that. I read that article.
There's more of a retraction of that out from the military as of yesterday.
Do tell.
Yeah, they're saying that it was actually a thought experiment and that it actually didn't really happen. It was being described as if it could happen.
Well, it was. I knew it was a simulation. It wasn't real. But
yeah,
I didn't,
yeah. That's what they were saying.
Oh, it was just a simulation.
Mm-hmm. But the robots came up with the idea, we can just kill the operator. And they said, you can't kill the operator. So they cut off communications because all they wanted was the points. So, I mean, which is the Terminator scenario, like, you know, playing out. So what's interesting is, you know, the questions that we've asked over time, because it's all about what if questions in science fiction, of course, and science, too. You know, the questions that we've asked have turned out to be pretty dead on the actual concerns we're having now that we're starting to realize some of this technology. And that's what's interesting, is everything went from being more fantastical to this is real.
It went from, you know, you say the word, it went from fantastical. So it went from a fantasy to saying to a science fiction, what if? And now we're in an age of, oh crap, what now?
Well, I mean, because I've got Alexa in every room of my house. They run all of my lights, all of my stuff is all wired up, you know, my Wi-Fi. Then I know a lot of people, I don't have one, but there's Roombas. People have had robot vacuums for a long time. I know a guy, there's a guy at Carnegie Mellon University who's the robotics professor there where I went to school, who actually has a robot that mows his lawn every week that he built, you know. So there's all kinds of...
If my house didn't have stairs, I'd be getting one of those Roombas. I love those.
I know, right? Right, right. And then there's all the different things that we, like Amazon has a robot that'll interact with your pets and you that you can buy. And I have a friend who has that. There's all kinds of different things. Then you see these robots that are actually, you know, the drones that go in and do the bomb sniffing, or the fake dog-like ones that they see that they're training to do different things. It's pretty incredible. And then, of course, we have sex bots, which is a thing now in a couple rare, I guess, not very many places that I know of, but I mean, you know, it's pretty wild. I mean, it proves the theory that robots could go anywhere and do anything. The question is, how much do we want them to do? And, you know, how far do we want to let them go? That, I think, are the questions that we struggle with.
Yeah. So we've got drones. We've got the dog robots. We've got the Amazon robot. All of our everything from fiction is now becoming real, what's robot fiction going to look like in 20 years when we have a robot housekeeper, when everybody has a robot who mows their lawn? What stories are we going to be telling then?
That's when you wonder if it's going to be so ordinary, people won't care about robot stories like they used to.
No, I think people will always care because they're weird and uncanny and fascinating because we want to interact with them like they're a person. You know, we're polite to Alexa. We don't yell at her. No, but they're not people.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll write stories about making our own sandwiches and what it felt like back when we did things ourselves.
We might write stories about trying to live a retro life and shut off the robots so we can do that stuff again.
I don't know. I'm going to keep my Roomba. I might write a story about what it would be like to vacuum my own house. But no, I'm going to let Roomba do that forever.
There is a secret to the stairs, by the way.
Yeah?
Yeah. I have an upstairs Rosie and a downstairs Rosie.
Oh,
And they're hooked into Alexa, so all I have to say is the name and then start downstairs Rosie.
You have solved my life problem right now.
And then I make the children vacuum the stairs. They're gonna grow up complaining about how they had to vacuum the stairs. And I'm gonna tell them, well, back in the olden days, I had to vacuum the whole freaking house.
And we had to lug the vacuum up the stairs.
Yes.
That's the one problem, is that how do you figure out your stairs problem? That's genius. There you go. So your kids are still getting some value, not taken away, of learning how to clean. There
All you right, go. So that needs to be, who makes those robot dogs? Is that Boston Dynamics?
Yeah, Boston Dynamics is the one I see the most often.
I adore them. But their new problem that they need to solve is a dog robot that can vacuum the stairs.
And make coffee. I think it should have a built-in espresso maker, too.
Oh, in the robot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then I'd have to, chase. I'm not chasing the espresso around the house.
No, that could be like...
So you whistle for it. It comes to you.
Sit down and relax while I clean for you.
I think we're going to be cleaning the robots, but that's okay.
Thanks for listening to Retro Rockets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Today, my guests are Brian Thomas Schmidt, Ken Scholes, and Martin Shoemaker, here to talk about the new anthology, Robots Through the Ages. You can listen to this episode and others at retrorocketspodcast.podbean.com. Join us to chat on Twitter. We're at RetroRocketsPod. So, Martin and Ken, I want to give you two the spotlight as well. How did you two get involved with this anthology?
Well, it was a dark night, dark and stormy night in the prison, and Brian sent a pigeon through with a note saying, "I need a story." I've known Brian for a while. I don't know exactly what year we met, but I believe it's been a while.
Like 2009, I think it was. When Lamentation, right before Lamentation came out.
So it was right before. Look, so Lamentation came out in 2009. I thought I knew you a little before that, but I've known Brian for a bit, and he's one of those folks where if he asks me for a story, I'm going to find him a story. I don't know how many things he has me in right now. A few. I know I'm in your COVID anthology. I'm in your Little Green Man anthology. But if Brian comes and asks for a story, I'm going to say yes. And he came asking initially for the original short story that introduced Isaac. My series is a 5-book series with Tor, but it didn't start that way. It started as a short story about a mechanical man. And that launched this 5-book series. But that first story where Isaac gets his name and meets his new friends and all of that, that was what Brian was going to pick up for this. But then the publisher came back and said, well, what if we had some new stories? And I don't know how it all came down. He'll tell the secrets, I'm sure. But it ended up that they wanted a new Isaac story. So I basically wrote, this is the first story set in the same world as my series after the events of my series. So it's a sequel about 5 years after the last book of my series. And it picks up with other characters, but Isaac is a central character in the story.
And Isaac is a mechanical man.
He's a mechanical man based on originally in the original story, he is a reproduction of the original Mecco Servitors. But by the end, when we meet him in this story, he's been overhauled. So
I'm going to come back to that in a minute. I want to ask you some more questions about Isaac. But Martin, how about you? How did you get involved in this anthology?
Well, like Ken, I've worked with Brian on a number of projects now, and I know they're always going to be quality projects that will get exposure and will have some really good stories in there to help mine look better because of what I get to stand behind. But Brian also has a secret. Based on my estimation from all of the feedback I get on social media, in person, and everything else, I think Brian may very well be the number two fan of my Today I Am Paul story and the Today I Am Carrie that came out of it. Sorry, Brian, my friend Bill Emerson's mother, the retired nurse, is a bigger fan than you because nurses are heroes in that series. And so here's this little old lady who doesn't read science fiction taking my book to all of her reading groups and pressing it on all of her nurse friends. So Brian scores number two. But when Brian calls me up and says, I'd like a Carrie story, the answer is, okay, give me 5 minutes. Okay, I have an idea. What do you think of this? And he said, start writing it.
Well, there's another key to this story, too, and without giving too much away. I have a dear friend whose daughter killed herself a few years ago, and she started a group called Speak Up, which is basically her way of dealing with the you know, of course, all the feelings related to the death of her daughter, is to teach people how to speak to people who are depressed, look for people who might be suicidal, and help open a dialogue, particularly in high schools and schools. And she's been going all over the country now. And when I went to Martin, I said, Martin, you know, I'm doing the side project and I'm doing this thing. And is there any way you could write a story that had anything to do with that? And the funny thing is, I don't know how much I told him about what they do, but what his story does is exactly what they do. When I finally got my friend to read it, she was like, oh my God, I never imagined you could tell our story this way. And you know, Martin didn't even really, I don't think you knew that much about it. So that's just the way things came together. So his story closes the book. If it doesn't make you cry, I'll be shocked. It's an amazing story.
So I better really, read really that funny. Story last.
Well, you will, because if you read the book in order.
Okay, so full disclosure, confession time. I'm one of those terrible readers. I don't read anthologies in order.
No, it's okay. I mean, you could do that. It actually works fine in most of my anthologies. The thing we try to avoid is putting things with the same feel and theme and all together. So you might mess that up and say, oh, why did I read three stories that sound the same? Well, they were actually not together in the book for a reason.
Right, totally my fault if they all sound the same.
Yeah. But for the most part, that's the whole beauty about anthologies. You should be able to read them in any order you want, especially in this case. None of these stories depend on the others necessarily for you to understand anything. So you can read them in any order you want. I wanted to say about Ken's. Now, I've been a fan of Psalms Isaac. The reason I connected with Ken first back in the day is because I grew up in a Christian household. And so I was seeing titles like Lamentation and things on his books. So I was thinking, wow, now who would write a book with the name Lamentation, man? I got to know more about this guy. And it turned out that we had a lot of things in common in our background related to both working in Christian music at one point, well, being worship leaders and that kind of thing. Long story, long time ago. But the point is that I was a fan of what he did with his, because I'm a huge Mechanical and Leibowitz fan. And he did a very similar feel to that, and kind of a space fantasy, kind of epic fantasy sci-fi mix that was really unique and really fascinating, post-apocalyptic, all that stuff that reminded me of Canonical Leibowitz. So when I think of a new robot story, I immediately thought of these two people. Shauna McGuire is a good friend as well. She did another story as well, but she doesn't have the already in her milieu a whole bunch of robot stories. These two did, and I definitely wanted their take on a robot.
Yeah, Martin and Ken, without spoilers, if possible, can you tell us a little bit more of the stories that you each contributed to the anthology?
Martin, you want to go first this time?
Sure. My original Android story, Today I Am Paul, was about an Android with a couple of, for all intents and purposes, superpowers. Just simple things, but it has empathy. It knows what you're feeling. It can read your body language. It can read your expression, your tone of voice. It knows what you're feeling. And its other superpower is it can emulate people that it knows. Not 100%. If you're paying it all attention, no, it's still an Android. But it has enough of the appearance and the mannerisms that it's like it is the person. And the novel is the story of Carrie the Android with 80 years with a family. Well, 80 years is a long time, and it's only like a 270-page story. So there's a lot of things that didn't happen in those 80 years. So I started to think, okay, what could have happened that wouldn't have changed the course of the main story, but tied into this empathy? And I started thinking about a friend of the family who's having serious troubles, and the android knows, but the android... This is semi-real world. It's our world, which means there are things like HIPAA. If the android has diagnosed you with a condition, it can't tell somebody else.
So what does it do?
It talks to you.
Oh.
And offers to be there for you and tries to listen and understand and help where it can. And it spends a day with this troubled friend trying to get through to her to try to help her, because it can't inform anybody. That's a health violation, but it can be there and it can listen.
Right. And it's the friend of, like, the best friend of the child that it's particularly close to, the android is taking care of at that time. So it's her best friend.
But the android can't even tell, this child about their friend having some troubles.
No, yep. But it can tell the friend about how much she means to people.
Oh, I'm getting chills just hearing about this.
So that's a recurring plot point in the novel as well, that if it knows something because you told it, it can tell anybody. But if it knows something because it diagnosed it, its programming won't let it tell anybody without your permission.
Right.
And then you still have the choice of to either give consent or not, or to even, say, yes, I think this is true about me or not.
Mm-hmm. Right. And his story, too, Today I Am Paul, which was kind of the origin of this, was about a caretaker, the robot taking care of a woman with Alzheimer's. So there, that was kind of, it's very well in line for Today I Know to have another caretaker situation. And the book, the novel was so, I mean, Today I'm Paul got a lot of notices, a lot of award nominations and a lot of recognition. It's been reprinted all over the place. But I thought, there's more to this story. And I was so moved by that novel. It was it was really a powerful, heartwarming story and heartbreaking in ways too. So, yeah, that's why I'm a fan. But anyway, and then, so I'm a fan of both these guys. And they write great robots. So,
all right. So Brian, I know you put Martin's story at the end for a reason, but I kind of feel like anybody that hears this is going to have to read that story first.
Well, look, you can. The reason I put it at the end is because, first of all, we did the opening. We opened the book with a new story by Shannon that had no ties to anything else, because we thought it's the easiest, most accessible way for people to say, I don't have to. A lot of people will walk in and they'll say, oh, this is part of a series. And they'll be frustrated because they haven't even given it a chance yet. This has none of those ties, so they can just start out with a fresh slate. Then we did a chronological order of the rest of the stories. So those two ended up at the end simply because they're the newest stories, because they were written for the book. But the reason that I chose to put Martin's at the end as opposed to Ken's, and I flip-flopped him a few times actually, was because I felt like Martin's is the one that is going to leave you with so much of the... Ken's leaves you with some questions, and they're great questions. And I like his story a lot, but Martin's is going to leave you with that emotional kind of resonance on a deeper level that I wanted people to walk away from with. So that's why. But I mean, you figure that out of the way first, doesn't mean you want to read it again. Hell, I've read that story so many times, I go back and read it to people because I'm so proud of Martin for writing that, and then I got to edit it. So there it is,
I have to say for Ken's story that I thought it was an awesome example of exploring spirituality within science fiction. Yes. And also, if George Lucas ever really wants to know how to do science fantasy right, he should talk to Ken.
Yeah.
Because that was so much better science fantasy than the trappings you get in Star Wars. You actually intermingled the two smoothly. They belong together.
Yeah, so Ken, tell us about your story.
Sure. Well, I'm taking... So it's all connected. This is an ongoing theme in my life. Everything's connected. And, in 2005, I was paying attention to all the markets. And there was a market called Lenox Avenue and they were doing a special issue on mechanical oddities. And I thought, well, I'm going to write a mechanical oddity story. And I've always loved robots. I've loved Tin Woodman in The Wizard of Oz and, you know, R2-D2. The first chapter book that I fell in love with was Runaway Robot by Lester Del Rey. And then there's Tweaky, R2-D2, C-3PO, Black Hole, all the robots that Brian was talking about, and Huey, Dewey, and Louie from Silent Running, all of the robots that influenced me. But I was just going to write a quick, half-assed science fantasy story, throwing it at a market, no plans whatsoever to do anything else with it ever again. And then I won Writers of the Future with a different story. And then Realms of Fantasy picked up the original Isaac story. And then it did well. But more importantly, they hired this artist named Alan Douglas. And I ran across his art that was going to be in Realms of Fantasy for my story. It's framed downstairs on my wall now, because the moment I saw it, I realized that Isaac's story was vastly bigger than what I thought. And I suddenly was inspired by a painting of Isaac that the artist made based on my short story about Isaac, was inspired to write a much bigger sequence. I thought it was going to be four short stories, but it ended up being five novels that Tor put out over a period of about 10 years. It took me a while. And so when Brian came to me, I actually was a little perplexed. The idea of writing a new Isaac story was not super exciting to me at first, because Isaac is the one character in my series who has never had a point of view. And I have always vowed that he won't. And so the challenge to me was, how do I use Isaac as a central character in a story that will work for Brian and for, I'm sorry, but oh my God, Robert freaking Silverberg,
right?
One of my heroes as well, right? I want them to like this story. But I also don't want to blow it for everybody who's never read my series. Now, I think that if you read this story without reading my series, you can appreciate the story. And I think it will spoil some parts of the series for you potentially, but that you could still really enjoy the five books of getting there if you want to.
We actually worked hard on that. We brought in somebody, a friend of mine who'd never read the series, because I've read all of Ken's stuff. So I was like, we got to bring somebody in and tell us where they're confused and where they feel like it's too inside. We worked really hard to make that so people shouldn't be afraid that they need to know stuff.
Yeah, I don't think they'll need to know stuff. The only thing that maybe that at the end of it, they're going to know, they know everything. They know some of the big secrets that happen at the end of the last book of the series.
Yeah. So it's all spoilers.
But that's kind of, but at the same time, I don't know that it's that important, to be honest.
Yeah, because you might know the reveal, but now you get to go on the journey to get there.
You get to go on, yeah, exactly.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And how it all comes together is fascinating, too. So it's a fun ride.
And so in this case, my story is a story about a guy named Tovin the Farseer, and he is the priest, for want of a better word, for a group of shipwrecks in an archipelago that were trying to escape for a better life, and they got stuck and lost, and they've been longing for home. And on the island where they crashed, they found a metal man in a posture of worship, pointing north toward a spire where they found an altar. And so their lives evolve into a kind of a mystery religion out there in the waters. And then one day, Tovin the Farseer, of course, when the story starts the one day he goes up to pray at the top of his hill and gets an answer. And then the story from there is about him making a new friend and finding a new home.
All right, real quick.
And discovering that it wasn't that far away from where he thought he needed to be.
Yeah, he was almost there and didn't even know it.
Yeah. And it explores faith as a muscle, as opposed to faith, the object that we put it in.
Yeah.
But a muscle of faith.
I want to come back just for a moment of, Ken, something that you mentioned real early on in our conversation. So Isaac is a mechanical man, a metal man. Mechanical man, robot.
Metal man, mechanical man, and he's called all of those things. Mecho servitor.
I don't know how to keep this a quick question, because this is a whole conversation. What's the difference between a mechanical man and a robot?
I don't draw any. I never call him a robot in my series, but I think they're all kind of, I think they're artificial humans, you know, that do human things for us. But I don't know the distinction.
Maybe there isn't one. Yeah, I don't know.
When looking at the terminology, and Bob and I were discussing it, I think mechanical man is kind of an earlier term than robot. And when people were trying to figure out, what do you call this kind of thing? Servitor was another one. And I think over time it evolved. And then, of course, the Kupek came up with this robot idea, and everybody grasped onto it because it's such an easy, fun word, robot, you know, that it kind of became the main thing. But when we're talking about this, it's not just about robots. This is about, of course, artificial intelligence. And there's androids and there's cyborgs, and all of them have something a little different about them. In fact, I don't think Carrie is an android, right? Not a robot.
I always call Carrie an android, but as I don't remember if it was Bob's essay or yours pointed out that when Lucas came along and started calling his robots droids, the terminology in the common culture just kind of blended, that android and robot in the popular usage are practically synonyms.
Yeah. They are.
It's always fun for me to play with the words, because you use a specific word for a specific reason, even if in common vernacular they can mean the same thing. We're always feeling pulled towards a specific word for a certain reason. We're using that phrase, and I'm falling down a rabbit hole that we do not have time for today. Well, so that'll be next time.
Words evolve through usage.
Yeah,
so that's
yeah.
Basically what it's down to, is that words have evolved into different meanings, and sometimes they get. You could look at them as being weakened, and sometimes they're strengthened depending on the circumstances. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for hanging out with me this afternoon, gentlemen. As our show comes to a close today, let our listeners know once again, where can we find you online? What's your website? Do you have any social media you want to share? Do you have any, you know, other books you want to give a mention to that you have coming out soon or recently? Brian, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Martin, and then we'll go to Ken.
Well, I had a really fun anthology called Hitherto Secrets of Marie Curie that came out, that is basically imagining Marie Curie's antics in high school. That's kind of fun. It's a YA anthology that's also out that might be fun. And I have my first hard science fiction near future thriller coming out called Shortcut, and that is actually optioned for a movie. It'll be coming out in September, and it's basically very similar in some ways to The Martian, although more of it takes place on Earth. And it's about a mathematician who figures out how to speed up space travel, and then his wife gets kidnapped and taken into space, and he has to figure out how to get her back. So it's a love story / thriller. It's kind of a fun story. So I have that coming up, and of course a bunch of different anthologies, another Joe Ledger in November, and all kinds of stuff. So
and tell us your website real quick.
Yes. I was just going to say that. BrianThomasSchmidt.net is where you can find me. I have a blog on there. There's a lot of writing and editing tips on there, a lot of really good content. I don't update it as often as I should, although I'm going to be updating it a lot more soon. And, of course, you know, you can find me on all those socials I mentioned earlier. Typically at Brian Thomas S is what I use with the social thing, but you just look for Brian Thomas Schmidt. You can pretty much find me, I think. And I also have a Wikipedia page if you want to know what all my works are. They're all, that's an easy way to find them. So.
Excellent. Thank you. How about you, Martin?
Find me at my website, shoemaker.space, or Martin L. Shoemaker on Facebook, shoemaker.space on Twitter. My next thing coming out is probably the grossest story I have ever written. It may get people canceling their Analog subscriptions. It's so gross, but Analog is putting out my, my next story. And now I've forgotten the name of it.
We'll come right back for that. Ken, real quick, I think we have about 30 seconds.
Sure, Ken, it's kenscholes.com, easily found, and glad to have been here with you today. Thanks.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. This was a fantastic episode. Thank you again. The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets.
Thank you.